Good morning, everyone. Before I actually start the lecture this morning, I'm going to ask you to bear with me and we're going to do a visualization. Normally that means you close your eyes, but this time we're not going to. We're simply going to, I'd like you first of all to look at the ceiling. And notice that there are 1, 2, 3 lights going across and there's 3 rows of them going across. So and I want you to imagine that the door that's there isn't there. There's only the exit door that we walk through, and that there's no windows here, and those doors are closed. So we're in a pretty much closed room, and our lighting's coming from the ceiling. Okay? Now I want you to imagine that it is about a year ago when we first moved into this facility, and there's boxes all over the place, and there's some chairs around here, and the gong is here. And you've gotten permission to come into this room because you're going to do some meditation and some work with the gong and to have the vibrations work in your energy field and so forth. You're here by yourself, okay? And so all of a sudden so you're sitting here, you're in a lotus position on the floor in front of the gong every so often. You give it a little bang there to get the vibration. Your shoes are off, you're barefooted. And all of a sudden, there's some sort of anomaly in the air, in the electric system, and there's this power surge of some sort, and all the light bulbs suddenly go very bright and explode. And there's glass all over the floor, and you're in a totally dark room, barefooted, with all this stuff around in chaos. How likely is it for you to be able to get out of this room without stepping on glass or stubbing your toe? Pretty unlikely. This is the situation the Fox sisters found themselves in. Because they were in a situation where they became the first real true mediums since biblical times, pretty much. Now, there always have been mediums on the planet, but there wasn't an organized movement around them. There were individual people who had the gifts and worked very quietly. And sometimes they worked a little bit more exposed, but that brought danger because many times the church was very much against this work. So many women in the Middle Ages would be herbalists and practice the gifts of the Spirit and then find themselves accused of witchcraft and burned at the stake. So there was a time where this was very dangerous. Just as Joan of Arc, probably the most famous medium of the Middle Ages, heard voices, helped to save her country, and she was burned at the stake for listening to the voices of spirit. So it was around, but it was very helter-skelter. So when the Fox sisters first became mediums, they didn't have anyone to talk with and to be mentored by. They had no teachers. Now some of us in this room are developing our own spiritual gifts, and most of us are learning it from someone else. We have teachers. We have someone, when we get discouraged and don't exactly know what's happening because all of a sudden things are changing and we don't understand it, we have someone to go to talk to help figure that out. The Fox sisters didn't. So they are truly what is called pioneers of spiritualism because they were the first ones out there. And because of what happened to them, they started a whole movement. They didn't intend to, but a whole movement grew about them. A whole religion grew out of what happened 163 years ago, last Thursday. So we're going to start talking. We're going to go like into a time machine and go back into December of 1847, and we're talking about a little tiny town called Hydesville, New York. Now, Hydesville is, I'm going to turn around because it's easier. Rochester's over here, and Hydesville's to the east over here, just about 20-25 miles east of Rochester. And it's near a town called Palmyra, which is only a couple of miles from there, and it's also about 15 miles from Seneca Falls, New York. And these three towns, Hydesville, Palmyra, and Seneca Falls, turned out to be a very interesting place in between the 1830s and the 1850s, this whole area. And we'll talk about that as we go. We'll start with Palmyra, because it's not really part of our topic, but it's kind of related. In Palmyra, in around 1830, there was a man there named Joseph Smith, and he had a vision. And because of his vision, the whole religion of Mormon, the Mormon religion, started, the Church of Latter-day Saints. And it happened in Palmyra, New York, which is only a few miles from Hinesville. This is kind of interesting. So there was a man, his name was John David Fox. He was a blacksmith. And he was building a house in Hinesville. But for some reason, his house wasn't ready yet, and he decided he wanted to move into the area. So he brought his wife with him, whose name was Margaret, and his two daughters, Margarita, which we call Maggie, and she was about 14 years old at the time, and Katie, who was 11 years old. And they went to move in this little cottage, which was a temporary housing for them until their house was being built, because they had farmland near there. I believe they inherited it. The family, there were two other members of the family. There was a son who lived nearby, but he doesn't play too much role in this whole story. But he lived nearby in Hinesville. And there was the oldest daughter, who was Leah, and she lived in Rochester, New York, which I said was about 25 miles, and she was about 35 at the time. She was much older. So the family moves into this little cottage. And they're not there for too long, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, they start hearing knockings on the walls, on the tables, on the furniture. And it scared the kids. They were frightened what's going on here. And so they ended up sleeping in the same room with their parents since that time. And this was continuously happening. Night after night, there was these knockings going on. And so they went to bed on the night of the 31st, and the knockings began again. And for some reason, Margaret snapped her fingers. That's the mother. She snapped her fingers, and spirit knocked right after that. And then the spirit, some of Margaret went, the spirit went. And for some reason, Katie, who was noticing this, shouted out, "Hey, Mr. Splitfoot," which is a name for a devil. And then I don't know why she said that, but all the sources say she said that. "Here, Mr. Splitfoot, do as I do." And she went, and spirit went. And that caught Margaret's attention. And because at that point they realized, well, whoever's making this noise, whatever, they have intelligence. They're mimicking what we're doing. Somebody knows what they're doing. That was the breakthrough. The fact that they found out that this wasn't just an accident. There was intelligence behind this. In actuality, they weren't the only ones having this phenomenon. There was another family. Their name was Davenports, and they were those medium. They became mediums, and they became known as the Davenport brothers. They were also in New York State, more towards Buffalo. And they are having the same things. They are having knockings in their house. But they never made the connection that it was intelligent experience until the Fox sisters did. And then they heard about it, and then they started talking to their knockings, and then their mediumship began. So the Fox sisters opened the doors, and the mother. So the mother finally asked, "Is this a human being who's making these noises?" There was silence. And then she said, "Is it a spirit making these noises?" And then they discovered that the spirit was knocking twice for yes and wouldn't knock for a no. So they started asking all these questions. And the mother asked, "How old are my daughters?" And the spirit knocks out 11 knocks, and it knocks out 14 knocks. And so forth. And then she finally says, "If I were to have my neighbors come into the house, would you continue to talk to us like this?" Two knocks for yes. So about an hour later, there was about 12 people in the house. And they started asking all kinds of questions. They were asking about the people who were there, like the neighbor, how many children did they have, how many people died in their family, and so forth. And the spirit was all knocking, giving the correct answer through knocking. And then they decided to find out more about this person who's doing the knocks. And they determined that The other thing that happened was that they were kind of limited to yes or no questions, which is kind of limiting. So they finally came up with the idea, well, let's ask you a question, and we'll say the alphabet, and you knock at the right letter. Kind of like a Ouija board, only instead of moving a planchette, they'd have to recite the alphabet. So they did this lengthy, tedious process, and they found out that the person who was talking to them was the spirit of a peddler who was murdered in that house. He was murdered in the bedroom 5 years before on a Tuesday night at 12 o'clock. The man who killed him, whose name was Mr. Bell, cut his throat with a butcher's knife. He took the body down to the cellar and buried it the next night 10 feet below the surface of the ground. And the spirit claimed that he was a peddler who was traveling around. In those days, there was a lot of traveling salesmen, which were peddlers, and he was carrying around $500 with him, which was equivalent for a whole year's worth salary for someone, you know, for someone working in those days. And he was killed because the person wanted the money. So this is what they learned from this whole thing. At another point in time, one of the neighbors also asked something, and it was kind of interesting because it was the first time that spirit was consulted on a more philosophical nature. She said, "Tell me, is there a heaven?" And there was a knock for yes. And she said, "My daughter, who died 2 years ago, is she in heaven?" And again, the answer was yes. So by this time, you can imagine it was late into the night, and the knocking still weren't stopping. So the Fox family stayed with neighbors that night because that was the only way they could escape the rappings. The rapping knockings are also called rappings, by the way. So the next night, which just happens to be April Fool's Day, a group of men came to the house and they started digging up the cellar because they wanted to see if they could find the bones of the body there. And they dug down about 3 feet, and then they suddenly hit a source of water, which started, you know, bubbling up, and they couldn't dig further, so they weren't successful in doing that. Meanwhile, this whole thing started to come out. You know, people started to learn of this, and more people would come to the house. They said that in a couple of days, half the whole county of Arcadia was there. There was hundreds of people coming to the house because they wanted to hear what was going on. And there was a man, his name was E.E. Lewis, and in 1848 he wrote a 40-page report about what happened to the Fox sisters. I'm going to just stop here for a second. On our church website, on the main page, on the left-hand column, you go down, you'll see an icon talking about the church bulletin board. If you click that, and then it gives us topics of past lectures. I've put down a bunch of links to the Fox sisters. One is to this particular book that I just mentioned. So if you want to read the actual source material of what happened back then, there are several different links that are there to actual source materials that you can go through. So what happened next is that Leah heard what was happening with her family in Rochester. And she decided to she was living in 11 Mechanic Square in Rochester. She was married, but she had been separated from her husband for about 20 years. And she was supporting herself by giving piano lessons. So she decided to go to Hydesville to see her family and see what's going on. So, and this is the part that I chuckle about, she got on a boat to go there. Now, today, there is no boat to go, you know, in the middle of New York State. But then there was the Erie Canal. And it was not only for transporting goods, but people could travel that way. So she hopped on the boat to go to Hydesville and to visit her family. And she got the bright idea that, see, what was happening was that the rappings were happening because of Katie, because Katie was the main medium. So Leah said, you know, if I take Katie back to Rochester with me, perhaps all this stuff will subside. So that's what they decided to do. And so Katie and Leah are on the boat, and lo and behold, there's knockings on the boat. So that obviously didn't work. But they didn't know at the time, you know. It was like nobody knew how this was working. Meanwhile, back in the house, the rappings continued because they began to use Maggie as the medium. Maggie and Leah and Katie were both good mediums. They both had the ability. And so did Leah. She had some, but she didn't have as much as the other two. And part of the reason for that was because the great-grandmother, Margaret's mother, Margaret's grandmother had quote second sight. She was clairvoyant. So the gifts of the spirit were in there. It was just, you know, they weren't practiced too much over the years because of the circumstances of it wasn't really safe to do at the time. And as you are going to discover, it wasn't too pleasant for the Fox sisters either most of the time. They did encounter a lot of resistance and a lot of hostility because of their mediumship. And their mediumship really affected their whole entire lives in a not positive way. Part of it was because they were the first ones. They were the ones going first. Now, we have to go back into the era of the time, okay? We have to think about the 1850s, and we were just talking about that a little bit. I was kind of chuckling that you were mentioning that as we were talking, because life was extremely different than it was today. First of all, you didn't have electricity, and when you don't have electricity, you don't have electric. You don't have TV and radio and television and CDs and all the stuff we entertain ourselves with. The only thing people did back then was they could read by candlelight. They went to dances. The men went to taverns. The women did a lot of needlework at night, and it was a very different life. And women's lives were totally different because could not vote. They could not hold a job. They couldn't go to college. They did learn to read, but they weren't allowed to go to college. They weren't allowed to own property, which meant that if their husband died, the house probably went to another relative who could easily kick them out. They couldn't sign contracts. And the one that, for some reason, surprised me the most was that they couldn't speak in public. And at one point, Carl and I had gone up to Lilydale, and we stopped in at Seneca Falls to the Women's Rights Museum, because in 1848, later the same year as the Fox sisters, women held a convention and they started to protest against all these things that they couldn't do. But it was really, I'm going to use the word scandalous in the time, because women weren't allowed to speak in public. They couldn't address an audience. They couldn't do this. And that the reason for that goes back to the Bible, back in the New Testament, in the 14th chapter of Corinthians, verse 35. It says it's shameful for a woman to speak in church. If she wants to learn anything, let her ask her husband at home. And it's in the Bible. So that biblical idea carried all through those centuries up to 1948, which for some reason never occurred to me. What's going to happen here is that also people were interested in death a lot more than people are today, partially because there was so much disease. People died from, if you got the flu, you could die because there wasn't penicillin around. There wasn't any antibiotics. So lots of people had death in their family, and of course, those people were interested when they found out that there was a way to communicate with people who had gone by. This became an interesting subject. At the women's convention, there was a man. His name was Elab W. Caprone, and he was the editor of the Auburn National Reformer. Auburn is another little town in that area, and he worked for the newspaper, and he was assigned to cover what was going on at the convention. But he had heard of the Fox sisters, and it intrigued him. And he went to visit them, and he became the first psychical researcher, one who was trying to look at the psychic phenomena. They feel, how is this working? Is this really real? Is this really communicating with people who have passed on, or is this some sort of hoax? So he came up with some ideas He had a bunch of shells that came from the lakes that are near there, because that's the Finger Lake region in New York. There's lots of lakes, and he picked up three shells, and he was with, you know, in front of one of the Fox sisters, and he asked the spirit, "How many shells do I have in my hand?" Three came out. Picked up five shells. "How many shells do I have in my hand?" He goes, "I wonder if they're reading my mind." So he goes and grabs a handful of shells. "How many shells do I have in my hand?" He didn't know how many he had in his hand. He hadn't looked yet. Spirit knocks out a number. He counts them up. It was the right number. So again, he was noticing that the spirit knew exactly what was going on. He ended up working with the Fox sisters, and he wrote a book himself about his experimentation, and that it's called The Explanation of and History of the Mysterious Communication with Spirits, and it's a very long title. That link is also on the website if you want to look at that. So by September of 1849, word had spread about this was happening, and there were evangelists who were saying this is the work of the devil. There were radical reformers out who were interested in this. There was people who had lost people, grief-stricken parents who wanted to talk to their sons and daughters, and there were skeptics. All these people became interested in, is this real, is this not real? And in the fall of 1849, Capone was there with the Fox sisters, and a message came through them that Spirit said that you have the duty to perform. We want you to make this matter more public. And they asked Capone to prepare some lectures about spirit communication. And there was another man, George Willis, and he was to be in charge of all the business affairs. And in November of the same year, November 14th, 1849, they rented the Corinthian Hall, which I find very interesting that it's called Corinthians, because the book of Corinthians talks about the gifts of the Spirit, which was the largest theater in Rochester, New York. And people paid 25 cents to go watch the first psychic demonstration of mediumship. The 400 people showed up. There were, of course, supporters. There were people who were there says, "I'm going to see this. I'm going to show it's a trick." And other people said, "I'm going to expose that it's really witchcraft." Because here, again, you have women who are doing this, and which was going against the norms of society in those days. Leah and Maggie were on stage. Katie didn't want to go. Again, she was the youngest, and she wasn't quite ready for all this. So Capone gave his lectures, and there was rappings going on during all this. And somewhere along this demonstration, people got the idea that we really need to investigate this further. So they picked a committee of people, and the next morning they met with the Fox sisters again. And they did the same type of thing, and they decided they couldn't figure out how this was done. And so they weren't saying it was fraud. And there was a meeting again the next night with all the people came back, and they found out that the committee couldn't find anything different, and people just couldn't accept this. It's very difficult for people to believe in the unseen. You know, even if you think about mediumship, okay, what we do in this church and other churches, other mediums, if you watch mediums on TV, you can watch John Edwards, doesn't matter which thing. No medium can absolutely 100% prove that's your loved one. If they're an evidential medium, they can give you a long list of evidence which describes that person. And you logically can say, the medium never met my grandfather. How did they know that? How would they know that this is all these qualities, that he was just like that? He's moving his hands like my grandfather did. He's using expressions like my grandfather did. It has to be my grandfather. But you're making a leap of faith in that, okay? There's a certain amount of there that is a leap of faith. And a lot of people can't do that. Their knowing this system, their belief system doesn't allow them to do that. Scientists especially, because with science it has to be proven, you know, and they don't want to make that leap of faith at all. So they formed the second committee, and this time they decided they're going to examine the sisters. And the sisters were asked to lay on a table, and they tied them down, and they felt their feet and their knees, because they thought that they were making these noises with the joints of the toes or the knees. It's not, you know, how people can crack their knuckles, and that's what they thought. Okay, how someone can crack a knuckle and fill up a whole large auditorium with the sound, that they didn't carry out the logic of it. So they submitted to that. They couldn't find anything wrong. They formed a third committee the next day. The next day, they decided to strip search the mediums, and look, you know, and including an internal examination, because they thought something was in their bodies to cause these sounds. The Fox sisters became hysterical with this. You have to understand this: we're back in the 1850s. For a man and a woman to be in a room together, it was a big deal. You know, they're not being chaperoned. So to have this happen was just way beyond any kind of their thinking. It was so out of the box that the Fox sisters became hysterical. Like I said, they paid a high price for their mediumship. And the end result, they couldn't prove that it was fraudulent at all. The Fox sisters then eventually they started to travel and do demonstrations in other places. The first place was Albany, New York. They went to New York City, where they met with several famous people. One included James Fenimore Cooper, who wrote The Last Mohegans, and William Cullen Bryant, who was the editor of the New York Evening Post. They went to Ohio. And they were conducting private seances, there were seances, they were doing public demonstrations, they were doing private readings. They were making a lot of money also, because people, they paid to go here, to see this, because it says in the book that I read that in the 4 years after the Hydesville knockings, they were estimated to be about tens of thousands of spiritualists in the country. They were estimated to be 40 to 50 mediums in Providence, Rhode Island, and 1,200 mediums in Cincinnati after the Fox sisters visited there. So the explosion of interest in mediumship happened because of what we spoke about before, the lack of electricity. This was something to do at night. People would get together and try to contact spirits, because I'll say it was a type of entertainment at the time, not to denigrate what's going on, but people didn't have anything else to do. So they were able to take the time to go and sit in a development circle and meet every week and develop their mediumship. So mediums and spirit takes whatever opportunity they can to communicate, because they don't have very many ways to do it. So so in effect, what happened was that the Fox sisters became very much what we term movie stars. They were making a lot of money. They were having quite public lives, and their lives turned out very kind of similar, like some of our movie stars, like Charlie Sheen and Lindsay Lohan. Okay, things started to kind of fall apart around them. Okay, and so yes, they lived the lifestyle, but their personal lives started to kind of fall apart. Leah got married in 1851. To Calvin Brown. A few years later, he died. Leah was married four times in total. It was claimed that she was very choosy at who she married. She would marry someone who had quite a bit of money and hopefully a little bit older than herself, so that she could be financially secure. That was a claim about Leah. Whether it's true or not, I can't say. As the girls got older, when they were around 15 and 19, and their mediumship became more of a problem, because of their maturity, for them to be sitting in a darkened room with men was not looked upon in polite society well. So they didn't have a good reputation just because of their profession. The fact that they were working was the fact that they weren't. It wasn't looked upon well. Maggie Fox went to Philadelphia one time, and she met Alicia Kent Kane, who was a medical officer in the United States Navy. He was a member of two Arctic expeditions. He became very attracted to Maggie. They wrote tons of letters back and forth, but Alicia was kind of like hot and cold about things, because while he was really attracted to Maggie, Maggie was not, did not meet, he came from a wealthy background, and his parents would not look upon his girlfriend as a medium in very good light. So he never really told them about Maggie. And he proposed marriage to her, and then he got cold. It was hot and cold quite a few times. And at one point, he went away on one of his trips. He came back, and he gave this document to Katie to sign, stating that they never had a relationship. She signed it. The next day, he showed up again. He had Maggie destroy it. Like I said, he was very back and forth about this. He tried to get Maggie to stop being a medium. He succeeded in sending her off to school to get an education while he went away on one of his trips. He didn't come back again for 29 months. He was away in the Arctic. And she stopped for a while, stopped doing her mediumship for a while. He came home. They were supposed to get married. They somehow got married, a pseudo-marriage, okay, which is they say is common in those days, where he married Maggie in front of Maggie's mother and a couple other witnesses, but it wasn't legal, totally. And he went off on a trip to England, and he died. And Maggie, of course, the family wouldn't acknowledge the marriage. And Cain had left her some money in his will, and the family didn't want to give it to her. So Maggie threatened to publish the letters, and they gave her a small amount of money. And then eventually she did publish the book of letters. So that was her up and downs, you know, love life type thing. Katie, on the other hand, started to work for, and this is a very common thing. Like I said, once we get into the 1850s, there are other mediums around, some other mediums. And one famous one was Daniel Douglas Holmes. He was in Connecticut for a while, and then he went to England. And he would stay with these wealthy people and read for them. And he ended up reading for a lot of kings and queens in England, in Europe, and so forth. And so he was being supported by wealthy families, as were the Fox sisters. Some of the Fox sisters, the same thing. Maggie was under the Cain family. And Katie started working for Charles F. Livermore. He was a banker. His wife had died. And she did a 5 years' worth of readings for him, 400 sittings for him, in which they kept records. Now, here is a prime example of a case where, having continuous practice in the mediumship, Katie's mediumship really developed. Not only was she doing the rappings, they never talk about the Fox sisters being clairaudient, being able to hear spirit and give a message. They never talk about that, but they talk about the rappings that happening, that levitate. She was a physical medium because she started to do levitations. Tables would rise, heavy tables would rise. There'd be spirit lights. You'd be able to see these lights in a darkened room. On the 43rd session of this 500 group, all of a sudden materialization took place. We've talked about where ectoplasm comes from the body, and it forms either a hand or a head or a full figure. And Livermore was able to have conversations with his wife, Estelle, who was in the spirit world. So this was going on for quite a while, and then Katie worked for the Taylor family. In the same situation, they lost lost some children, and she worked for them holding seances. And eventually spirit said, "We want Katie to go to England." So Livermore sent Katie to England, where she came in contact with Sir William Crookes. Sir William Crookes was a Nobel-winning physicist. He founded the discovery of thallium, which is one of the elements or something. He was a very renowned scientist, science world. His reputation kind of started going downhill because he got interested in psychic phenomena. And he started to do psychical research. And he got a hold of D.D. Holmes in England, someone called, I can't think of her name. Another medium, it's probably here someplace. and Katie Fox. And he did all kinds of experiments. That was all written up and so forth. And he couldn't find any fraud with them either. But again, he was willing to take that leap of faith, which was very unusual for a scientist. But in the process of that, Katie met the man she would marry. His last name was Jenkins. And during their wedding ceremony, there was lots of raps. And then there was a table there with all the wedding gifts, which was levitating up in the air. So Spirit was finally happy that Katie had a happy turnout, at least for a while. Katie had two children with him, but he died. They were married for 10 years, and he died. Katie, in the meantime, had returned back to New York City. At that point in time, we were about around 1881, Maggie had become an alcoholic because of her problems. Katie also became an alcoholic because of her problems. I think Leah had an alcoholic problem too, but so did the father. And today we understand how alcoholism travels in families as well as the gifts of the spirit. But those days, you know, they weren't so sure. Katie was arrested for neglecting her sons. The sons were put off in what they called the juvenile asylum in those days, which was a place they would remove children from because Katie was drunk too much and they felt that she wasn't up to taking care of her children. But they were released eventually, and Kate went back to England for a while. In the fall of 1888, Maggie was on very hard times. She wasn't making money on her mediumship, and she accepted an offer from a reporter for $1,500, and again, that's a lot of money in those days, if she would expose her methods to him and give him an exclusive story of how these wrappings were really made. So on October 21st, 1888, there was a meeting at the Academy of Music in New York, and Maggie addressed 2,000 people. Katie was also there. But they always talk about Maggie, so I don't think Katie said too much. And she made a statement that her mediumship was all fraud, that she was clicking her knuckles or her toes or whatever. And there was a book published on that, The Death Blow to Spiritualism, in 1888. A year later, she recants all this. And she said it wasn't true, that Spirit wanted her to come forward. She said she kind of made a vague reference that because Cain was Catholic, she had become Catholic after he died, and there were certain Catholics who were very much against mediumship, and they were pressuring her to expose this as fraud, which she did and then took back. So we can see that the Fox sisters had a very up and down, chaotic life because of their mediumship. I tend to look at it because they didn't have very many people they could trust. Now, there were lots of mediums. By the time this ended, there was lots of mediums around. But somehow they weren't nurtured. They didn't have anyone to kind of help them along the way of this. One of the sources that I ran into this quote, it was made by Dr. Samuel Byron Britton, who was a publisher of the Spiritual Telegraph, which was a spiritualist newspaper at the time. And he made this statement in a seance because he had already transitioned to the spirit world. So he came through and he said, quote, "Life has not been full of sunshine for the Fox sisters." And he went on to claim, although Maggie was a genuine medium with wonderful gifts, the band of spirits attending her during the early part of her career no longer assisted her. Instead, other spirits from a lower realm, who are not scrupulous in their dealings with humanity, are now her spirit companions. So what he's saying was there was a shift in the spirit people that worked with her, because one of the things we understand is that like attracts like. So if you do this work with good intentions, and with the focus on the higher good for people, you attract the higher spirit realm. But if mediums start to think that they're I'll use the phrase "all that," or that they're it's them. They have this wonderful gift, and they are producing it. It's not the spirit that's giving the information. That explosion of ego, okay, turns off the spirit people from the higher realms, and they kind of withdraw. And so that allows other spirits to kind of fill the gap. And unless the medium is really quite very sensitive and can feel the change of what's going on, okay, and some people can, and some people can't, it depends how well they feel, then they might not even be aware there was a change in group. And unfortunately, the personal lives and the hardships that these mediums produce. So you think about this. How easy is it for you to take criticism? These people were constantly being bombarded by people who would not believe them, who were out to prove that they were fraudulent. That constant negativity is coming towards you. And if you're a medium and you're sensitive, it's very hard to deflect that. You either have to know what you're doing is right 100%, which is easy for us because we have 150 years of mediumship to look back on. These are the first ones. They didn't have that. So they constantly, you know, that strip shows must have really shook them up. It had to have. So it was this constant confrontation with negativity that kind of wore them away. Plus their predisposition to alcoholism, you know, it just filled in the gap. And this is kind of what happened here with them. Between 1890 and 93, all three sisters died. Two of them were penniless, and they were buried in pauper's graves in New York City. Leah had more money, and so that didn't happen to her. It's interesting that in the same year that the last sister died, who was Maggie, was the year that the National Spiritual Association was formed. And today that's known as the National Spiritual Association of Churches. It's the main spiritualist group in the United States. Their headquarters is in Lilydale, New York. In 1915, that group of churches managed to move the Fox Cottage off from Hydesville onto their property, where it stood until 1955, when it burned down for whatever reason. And in 1998, they bought the Hydesville property. They excavated the site and exposed the foundation and built another structure over it, and it's become like a memorial to the founding of spiritualism. So when I read this book a while back, I just found it so interesting that so much detail and information existed about these people and about how all this happened. And the fact that these original source documents were still around, and I just marveled at the lives that they led, you know, the good and the bad, and how the struggle that they had to bring their truth to the world, and what it cost them. I just found that something that I thought was worthwhile knowing about. So that's why I presented it to you on this anniversary. Thank you very much.